I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Higher Ed to order. Today we have got presentations from student and faculty groups from the University of Minnesota and from MNSCU. My understanding is we will be starting with the interfaculty organization with Mr. Stanton. Okay. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a handout that I think Jason has. Madam Chair, and members of the committee, first of all, I'm Russ Stanton. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. We had hoped to have Don Larson, who is the president of the IFO, here to speak today, but unfortunately his father passed away yesterday, and so I'm filling in for him. The Interfaculty Organization, or IFO as we're more commonly known as, is the union for the faculty at the seven state universities. Those universities would be Bemidji, St. Cloud, Mankato, Winona, Metro, and Southwest, and Moorhead. About 4,000 full and part-time faculty that teach at the state universities. The IFO actually started out as a professional organization back in 1938 of the faculty, and then in the 1970s when the legislature passed PELRA, the collective bargaining law, IFO won the representational election, and they've represented the faculty at the state universities ever since then. The IFO members are very proud of the work that they do and the contributions that they make to society. Our members are the people who teach the and graduate the mid-range professionals at the state universities. Along with the two-year colleagues, they produce 49% of the teachers. They produce 83% of the nursing graduates. They produce 35% of the business graduates. These are the graduates that go on to staff our hospitals, our schools, our small businesses around the state. They're the graduates that make our state work and function on a day-to-day basis. They're also proud of what they directly do for students. The IFO educates students that are often the first in their families to attend college. And they develop these students into productive and self-supporting citizens of our state. The IFO, what they do is they produce graduates with bachelor's and master's degrees, and that's very important. The average person with a bachelor's degree earns about 35% more during their lifetime in any given year than the average person with just a high school education. The average person with a master's degree earns about 101% more than somebody with a high school degree. And they not only do people with bachelor's and master's degree earn more money, but they suffer less unemployment. In 2009, people with less than a high school education suffered from 14.9% unemployment. Those with a high school education, 9.7%. Those with an associate degree, only 6.3% unemployment. Those with a bachelor's degree, 5.2%, and those with a master's, 3.2%. And the reason I mention that is that higher education adds measurable value to students' lives, and it's the faculty that deliver that education to these students. The faculty at the state universities are extremely efficient at what they do in educating students, and they're very proud of that efficiency. The instructional costs per student at state universities are among the lowest in the nation, and because of that, our colleges and universities are some of the most affordable in the state. Tuition and fees at state universities are $6,596 per year. Compare that to, for instance, the Gustavus tuition, $33,858 a year, St. John's, $31,576, St. Ben's, $32,246, and the U of M, $91. State universities and community colleges are a very, very good buy because they're very efficiently run. Not only are they efficient, but I think our faculty have always been very flexible and very responsive to the needs of our and problems of our universities. For instance, several years back, a number of years ago, the universities were having great difficulty hiring people in high-demand fields, fields like finance or accounting and so forth. And the faculty did modify their contract to allow the new hires to be brought in anywhere on the scale. They could be hired anywhere from $43,000 to $114,000 in order to accommodate market demands. When the recession hit a couple of years ago, our faculty, I think, were very realistic. They realized there'd be no money to negotiate for anyhow. So they came forward and they said, how about if we just suspend this round of negotiations, carry our contract forward with a two-year freeze, with no across-the-board steps or pay increases. And they continue to be flexible. One of the things that we're involved in right now is interest-based bargaining with MNSCU, which is basically how interest-based bargaining works is you kind of set aside the adversarial way of bargaining, and you look at what mutual interests you might have and how you might be innovative and creative in having a win-win solution to those problems that are identified. IFO we have lots of goals this session, too many to even begin to address here, but our one very, very large goal that most of our other goals are related to is our legislative concern is, that we'd like to bring to your attention is that the state's commitment to higher education has been slipping very, very badly and at a time when we need higher education more than ever. I think you're by now all quite familiar with the Georgetown University study that projects that 70% of the new jobs in Minnesota between now and 2018 are going to require a post-secondary degree. We're only 48% of the people between 25 and 34 have a post-secondary certificate or degree. There'll be an estimated 902,000 new job openings. 620,000 of those are going to require post-secondary degrees. The state is really going to have to start cranking up its effort and its capacity if we're even going to come close to meeting the demand for post-secondary graduates. And unfortunately, what we're doing is we're cutting our capacity. I passed out something that I had referred to the last time I testified, and I wanted to bring to your attention. If you go to the legislative library, you can find Congressional Quarterly puts out state rankings 2010. They put this out each year, how states rank. And I copied the page on the back of this, the chart of per capita spending on higher education and by state. And this covers for all higher education, public, you know, any public education, whether it's financial aid or University of Minnesota, MNSCU, whatever. And basically what's happened is Minnesota, which used to be near the top, is now at 28th in the nation in terms of per capita support of higher education. We're behind North Dakota at number 2. We're behind Iowa at number 7. We're behind Wisconsin at number 12. We're even behind states like Alabama and Mississippi and Arkansas. I mean, states that, quite frankly, we used to look down our nose at. But those states are investing big time in higher education right now because they know it's the competitive edge in the future. And I guess what the message we'd like to leave with you is kind of a wake-up call. Minnesota has been neglecting its higher education commitment for some time, and we're going to have to start paying attention to it, even in hard times. Thank you. I'd like to now turn it over to Monty Butte, who's one of our faculty members from Metro State.
Mr. Butte, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. It's good to be back and see some familiar faces. I do notice that you have made one change since I was last here. You've rearranged the deck chairs on the Titanic. joking aside, our ship estate is really floundering right now in turbulent seas. All of us here today, including those testifying and legislators, are defending our interests in one way or another. That's a given. And that's as it should be in the legislative process. However, I think when it comes to higher education, there is a greater good that should transcend each of our narrower self-interests. We operate in an environment where starkly polarized opinions about how to solve our budgetary crisis dominate policy discussions. However, there seems to be unanimous agreement on one issue. From the business partnership in the Chamber of Commerce to the AFL-CIO and the Citizens League, there is a consensus that the key to prosperity and well-being for the state of Minnesota and its citizens is an educated workforce. Now, higher education was once seen as a public good, similar to public safety and transportation. From 1960 to the year 2000, governors and legislators treated it as such. Unfortunately, during the last decade, we have abandoned that heritage. The previous governor and successive legislatures began treating higher education as a private good, substituting student loans and aid for state appropriations has been a cruel shell game for the current generation of students. In the early 80s, and I've sent a handout around, you can look at some of the chart on it, but in the early 80s, the state's share of public education was still roughly 80%, with students picking up the other 20%. For the next two decades, the state's share was roughly two-thirds. Since 2002, public college students and their families have been swamped by a tuition tsunami. The state's commitment to sharing college costs has shrunk to 43%. Students at state universities are far more likely to come from modest means. They work too many hours, usually at low wages, take more credits than they can handle, and given the state's tuition policy, they end up with debt that seems as insurmountable as that of the federal government. In Minnesota, quality education should not be limited to the well-to-do or to those willing to mortgage their futures with excessive student loans. Now, my days as an active citizen and public servant are numbered. As some of you on the committee know, I am battling a rare and terminal cancer. That harsh reality forces one to reflect upon his or her life. I grew up a farm boy in southwestern Minnesota. My parents struggled to eke out a living on an 80-acre farm. Their education was limited, and college was not on our radar screen. Given that background, how did I become a college professor? Simply put, I had access to high quality and reasonably priced public education. In today's climate, it is highly unlikely that I would have been able to take those first tentative steps at Austin Junior College. Now, for whatever contributions I have made during the past 40 years to the public good of this state, I owe an enormous debt of gratitude to those visionary political leaders of the 1960s and 70s, whose long-term investment in my generation's higher education continues to pay high dividends for the state of Minnesota. I ask you personally today to do no less for our children and for our children's children. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buten, and I know that we all wish you the best in your fight with cancer. But thank you very much for being here today. And Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I just have to say that Professor Butte looks a lot better now being in remission than you did a year ago when you came before this committee.
Yes. So, let's hope it lasts.
Let's hope it lasts.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
We will now move on to the University of Minnesota students and Matthew Forstie and Peter Urkilla.
Urkel.
Thank you both for being here. If you could just identify yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members. My name is Peter Urkilla. I'm here today with Matt, of course, on behalf of University of Minnesota Twin Cities students. I'm currently a sophomore at the university studying political science and history. I want to talk to you a little bit today about the university and about the problems students face, but before I do that, I want to talk about the way that the University of Minnesota affects people's lives, not just students, but everyone in our state. It affected my life since I was born. I was born in St. Paul, but grew up in Grand Rapids, which is where I call home. My father was educated at the University of Minnesota, eventually receiving a doctorate in forestry. And ever since I can remember, he's been faculty as well, heading up the North Central Research and Outreach Center in Grand Rapids. Growing up, I was surrounded by alumni and faculty within my own family. My mother, my brother, cousins, and aunts have all been either educated, or not all of them, but many of them have been educated at the university, and a number of them contribute there as faculty. During high school, I was keenly aware of the presence the university had there as well. Due to a rigid schedule, I was never able to take advantage of the college and the schools classes offered at Grand Rapids High School, but I had a close friend who did, and he went on to receive college credit when he went to UMD, and he doesn't spare any opportunity to remind me that he'll be graduating before I will. It was also during my high school years that the university played a very major part in my life. In 2006, my dad was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and it was doctors at the university's Center for Prostate Cancer who successfully performed his surgery. As I got closer to graduating from high school, I made the decision that the university was the place I was going to come. I heard the usual concerns, people asking me, what about the large class sizes and the professors more concerned with research and all these things. But when I got to the U, when I was finally enrolled there, I found that only one of my classes in my freshman semester was over 100 people. All of the others were about 20 or less. My next semester was about the same, and my only class with over 100 people was one that was taught by a former vice president of the United States. I've been offered a lot of great opportunities at the university, including being able to be here today. My instructors, both professors and graduate students, have been engaging and helpful. And although the campus is large, I wouldn't trade the diversity that you find on it for anything. The university is a place that is both engaging and challenging to students. What I found out is that the experience that I've had with the university, both as a student and outside my life, isn't unique to me. The U of M has a positive effect on people's lives on campus and across the state. But students today face a lot of challenges in pursuing their education and being part of what the university has to offer. Last year, tuition went up 4.4% for Minnesota residents and 7.5% for out-of-state residents. On average, that's about $600 for a resident student and about $1,000 for a non-resident student. And that's after the additional federal stimulus funding. So without that, the increase likely would have been higher. In the last 10 years, tuition at the University of Minnesota has increased over 134%. This ongoing trend makes it challenging not only for lower-income families, but for middle-income families such as myself. I'm lucky to have parents who are willing and able to make a significant contribution to my education. But a lot of students aren't that lucky. And I'm not, and just because my parents are able to make that contribution doesn't mean I'm getting off scot-free. I'll end my education with a significant amount of student loans as well. Tuition isn't the only way that cutbacks and funding restrictions or funding reductions affect students. Higher student fees, less student services, less faculty, and larger classes all are contributing factors to the decline in the quality of education at the University of Minnesota. The legislature obviously has some serious budget issues and a tough situation and a lot of tough choices to make. But the choices you make have a serious impact on university students. As a student, I can see the immediate effects of budget cuts firsthand. I can see when my classes are larger. I can see on my fees statement when fees have increased, and I can see tuition going up. But what I can't see are the ramifications long-term of these cuts. The way the U has shaped my life before I was even a student was a huge part of who I am today, and I wouldn't want to think that other people down the line will be deprived of the opportunities I've had and the effect that it's had on my life as well. It is not in the interest of students or our state as a whole to cut disproportionately from higher education. The University of Minnesota is a resource. It's a resource that has had a positive effect on my life and the lives of other students just like me and will continue to improve our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Forstie.
Yeah, Forstie.
Thank you very much. I am so sorry.
You got it right the first time. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Forstie. I am a freshman student at the U of M, and I'm also a member of the Undergraduate Student Association. I'll be majoring in economics, graduating in spring 2014. And I'll kind of do the same thing that Peter did here. I'd like to briefly share with you my own story about how I ended up at the U of M. And I'd also like to tell you about how the U has affected my life and how I think it's affecting my future. So I'll start by telling you how I ended up at the U. And it's kind of I didn't expect to end up at the U. So I'll take us back about 18 months to when I was in the fall or... Yeah, when I was in the fall of the senior year of my high school, and I was just starting my college applications and admissions process, which is admittedly stressful for many students these days. And the true reason I'm telling you this story is because at the time I was dead set on what I thought I wanted to do for college, and that was go out of state to probably a private university. And when I started to talk to my parents and my family about that, they were a little surprised and a little dismayed because both of my parents graduated from the U of M, and my grandfather's a U of M alumni, and some aunts and uncles, and so forth. So what they told me is that I should take more of a balanced approach to my potential college portfolio, and that I should take a look at the U of M. And I can say today that I'm extremely grateful for them telling me to take that step. So what ended up happening when I started looking into the U of M, into the programs and the academics, rankings, research, and all the things that any student, any college-bound student looks into when they're researching colleges, when I did that, I found that the U was more than competitive in every single area with out-of-state, public, private institutions all over the country, the highest regarded institutions in the world. The U was at the top of those lists. So in the end, that decision was a no-brainer for me. I chose to attend the U, and the cherry on top of that decision was I got to stay in the state that I grew up in, and I got to attend a public institution, and I got to pay in-state tuition. And before I move on to other things, I'd like to say that I wasn't the only person in that situation that made that decision. Dozens and dozens of my high school classmates made that same decision and went through that same process that I did. So I think the U is truly attracting the best students in the state of Minnesota, educating them here and keeping them here. And I think that all of us really have learned the valuable lesson of what it means to be a public school student. And so with that, I'd like to move on, and I'll talk about now what I'm doing at the U. And there's really only one thing that I really want to highlight, and that's making my my experience at the U really unique. And that's that I'm working this semester as a research assistant, as a freshman, at the University of Minnesota's Population Center. The project that I'm working on actually specifically is called the Flexible Work and Wellbeing Study, which it turns out you'll be hearing a little bit about later from Professor Moen. But what I want to highlight is that I don't think you would hear from many or any other students that attend other universities that they're involved with research as a freshman, or even in other stages of their undergraduate education. At the U, freshmen, sophomores, upperclassmen, all undergraduates of all types are involved with research, whether it's like me as a research assistant on a project, or they applied for a grant and they're heading up a project themselves. So that's really a special part of the university's mission, and something that makes us special. And for me, in addition to gaining that valuable experience working in that professional environment, that research environment, I'm getting paid for it. It's a job, so I'm using that money to mitigate my tuition bill. And that brings me now to the subject of cost, which I'll talk about just briefly before ending. I'd like to say first that I believe, and I think that all students believe now, that all students should have a stake in their own education, a financial stake. And I don't think you'll see, I don't think anyone sees many students nowadays that don't have that financial stake. And for some students, that financial stake is unfortunately becoming too large to handle. So, like Peter said, tuition has risen 134% in the last decade at the U of M. Students can't sustain those levels of increases going forward. We can't continue to pay that. So I guess what I'll say is that state support is really essential to setting the precedent for tuition increase or tuition in general going forward. If the precedent continues to be set of double-digit tuition increases a year, you know, maybe we'll see in the next decade 150% increase, and that's something we can't handle as students. So I'll just conclude by saying that I truly hope that you keep students in mind when you make the difficult decisions that you have to make this session. And I think me and Peter now will stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments from the committee? Senator Saxog.
Just one comment, Madam Chair, and kind of in line with what the two gentlemen were telling us. We talk a lot about how there's a possibility that the state of Minnesota is not competitive in the job market. And we don't compete on a tax standpoint or because we have snowy winters or whatever. But the one thing we have always had is a trained, educated workforce and the ability to bring people from North and South Dakota and Iowa and Wisconsin and all over the world here to be educated. And statistics will show, and the private college is the same way, the people come to Minnesota and are educated probably stay here. Right, Senator Anderson?
Got it. Mm-hmm.
So I think that if we're really serious about jobs and economic vitality, that it's pretty important that we stay competitive in the higher education market and draw people in. And whenever we get tuition as high as we are right now, I hear the sucking sound, and it's coming from people leaving Minnesota, not staying here.
Good point. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you being here today. The next group we have with us today is the Minnesota State College Student Association, Mr. Ditburner. Mr. Potter Rank, Ms., I apologize, I wrote it wrong, and Ms. Nelson and Ms. Juanas. and I apologize if I slaughtered those names, but thank you very much for being here.
Good afternoon, Chair Fischbach, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Dippner. I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. We're the organization that represents the students of the two-year community and technical college students of the state. With me today is Samantha Potter Rank, a student at Inver Hills Community College, Maureen Wanius, a student at South Central College, and Deb Nelson, a student at Century College. It's our hope today that we can provide you with a snapshot of how the Minsky system's impact on students and the challenges facing students at our community technical colleges with regard to quality, affordability, and accessibility in higher education. With 54 campuses and 47 communities throughout Minnesota, the Minsky system serves all corners of the state. These institutions are often the driving forces behind local and regional economies, and it's our colleges that will provide the well-trained and highly skilled workforce that Minnesota really needs to get back on track. And, without a strong Minsky system, it will be impossible for the state to meet the future workforce needs or to provide the retraining and educational opportunities so many workers need and so many Minnesota businesses are clamoring for. As I'm sure you know, our past budget deficits have hit public higher education very hard. Over the last 10 years, students have paid for the majority of these budget cuts in the form of tuition hikes that have far outpaced the rate of inflation. Tuition and fees at Minsky's two-year colleges have nearly doubled in the past 10 years, and our schools are the third most expensive with average tuition and fees in the country and far and away the most expensive in the Midwest. Increases in tuition have led to significant increases in tuition student debt. From fiscal year 2009 to fiscal year 2010, student borrowing increased in the Minsky system by 19%. During the same time, the number of students taking out loans increased by 15%. Since fiscal year 2003, the average amount borrowed by a student has increased by 53%, from $4,441 to $6,788. The state of Minnesota faces a historic budget deficit, and solving this is not going to be easy. What's needed now is a transformation in the way we structure and deliver higher education so that we can create a financially sustainable system in the long term. We can't simply continue the status quo and hope things will get better over time. Time and time again, cuts to the Minsky system have resulted in higher tuition, more student debt, faculty layoffs, and increased class sizes. None of these things are good for the students of our state. As you work to determine what the future of higher education will look like, I urge you to keep the Minsky core system principles, priorities, quality, access, and affordability at the front of your minds. It has been consistently proven that college education is the driving force that allows people to lift themselves up and make a better life for themselves and their families. With me today are three students who are getting an education for that very purpose, and at this time, I'd like to invite you to listen to their stories.
Thank you very much. If you could just identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Chair Fischbach and members, my name is Samantha Potter-Rank, and I'm a 17-year-old post-secondary enrollment options, or PSEO, college student. I go to Inver Hills Community College in Inver Grove Heights. When I first thought of the idea of PSEO, I was terrified. I couldn't imagine leaving all my friends behind. Many questions ran through my head, like what if college is too hard? What if I made the wrong choice? Is college just going to be a waste of my time? I can tell you this, though. College is definitely not a waste of my time. I know I made the right choice. I chose to do PSEO because if I worked hard enough, I could graduate college with my associate in arts degree before I graduated from high school. I could also earn my associate in arts degree without paying any tuition. This saved my family a lot of money. I live with my mom and my sister, and our total income is less than $25,000. This got me thinking that if I could kick out 2 years of college while still in high school, that would save me thousands of tuition dollars. More specifically, after graduation, I will have saved nearly $10,000. The PSEO program helped me get 2 years of college out of the way without any debt. This was the ultimate selling point for me. During my first semester, I was still anxious, of course. I ate lunch alone and was often in the library studying. I had no friends at that point, and I honestly thought that I had made the wrong choice. Maybe college wasn't for me. That was until someone introduced me to Student Senate and Student Life. I became part of both, and my social life took off. I was getting involved, and I really felt like I was making a difference. I was introduced to more people and finally felt like I belonged. By attending Inverhills Community College, I was completely transformed. I took on leadership roles, joined clubs, and diversified my thoughts and beliefs. Not only did I get to personally witness my own transformation, I got to watch the closest people around me transform. And if you've never seen that, boy, is it cool. I watched them break out of their shells and excel. They pushed me to move forward, and I pushed them. This isn't the end of the road for me. Thanks to support from my friends, staff, and faculty, encouraging me to finish what I start, in May this year, I will graduate from Inverhills Community College and Hastings High School. One of my favorite quotes from my friends is, "See these two hands? They're going to change the world." And I can guarantee you that that is the case with me. Last week, I found out that I was accepted into the University of Minnesota, where I plan to study pre-med. I'm excited to stay in Minnesota because this is one of the best places to get higher education in the nation. If I have my way, I will be a pediatric oncologist, and I will be researching cancer. I decided to go into oncology because when I was about 12, my mom developed cervical cancer. This is one of the hardest things I've ever had to go through. I'm here to put an end to cancer. Who knows, maybe you'll see me on the news for curing cancer someday. I can't achieve this without further education, though, and without state support for affordable, accessible, and quality education. Without this support, fewer students will be trained into the workforce. Without a trained workforce, there are more people depending on the government, and ultimately less taxes are being paid. It has a snowball effect. We need to support our students of all ages. I can tell you that I'm not someone who comes from a wealthy family. I have 10-plus years of schooling left, and there's no way I can afford to finish without going through a lot of debt as tuition continues to rise. If I successfully become an oncologist, I should be in a position to repay the debt I incur, but I am just one student out of hundreds and thousands. They are out there wondering how to pay for college. They are wondering if they should pick up an extra shift to put gas in the car. They are wondering if college is even worth it, just like I was. If we keep raising tuition, people are not going to be able to afford it and contribute to the economy after graduation in a significant way, and they won't be able to finish what they start. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here.
Madam Chair and members, hello. My name is Maureen Wanyas, and I am a student at South Central College in Faribault, Minnesota. I'm in the Medical Laboratory Technician Phlebotomy Program there, as well as Student Senate President. I'm here today to talk to you about why I decided to go back to school after 7 years of being away. I decided to go back to school because I wanted to make a better life for myself and my daughter, Lola, who is 9 years old now. I was tired of working on minimum wage jobs and living paycheck to paycheck. I knew I could do something more with my life, and I wanted Lola to see how important it was to get an education. After much consideration, I chose South Central College because it was close to home and it had the program I was looking for. At first, I went to school just to get it done and move on with the next phase of my life. But as I got more into the college experience, I realized that college is more about just getting a job. It's also becoming a part of your community and learning to grow as a person. I got into the Student Senate in the fall of 2009 as an executive senator, and I've moved up through the ranks, and now I'm president. I have fully enjoyed my time at SCC, but it's been hard because I've had to work so much to pay for tuition and to support Lola. I work in the library at school as an assistant to the librarian around 15 hours a week. I also work 3 shifts at Pizza Ranch in Owatonna as a shift manager and 4 shifts a week at Old Town Bagels as a dough maker. I need to work this much because I'm trying to get through school without having to take on more debt than I will be able to pay back. I still have to take out loans to balance it all, though. But there is a big downside to working this much. Lola doesn't get to see me as often, and that's hard for her and for me. I've also taken longer to complete my degree because my credit load has varied based on my work schedule. I need to work this much, though, because I have responsibilities that I need to take care of, one is which school tuition, books, and the rest of the expenses that come along with going to school. I'm thankful that my grandparents 2 years ago let me move in with them to help me save on rent and utilities and so forth. But there's a lot of people in this state that don't get this luxury. They struggle to make ends meet while balancing school and work. And some of these people drop out of school and work at jobs that don't go anywhere or improve their situations. That is why I believe that you need to think of the students when making your decisions on how to fund the MNSCU system. In the past, cuts to the system have been passed on to the students in form of tuition increases. One of the great things about MNSCU system, it is open to everyone who wants to have an education. But we need your help to make sure that college is affordable and available to every Minnesotan who wants to improve their life. I struggle to balance work and school, but I'm willing to go through this struggle because I know at the end of the tunnel, things will be better for Lola and myself. She will not have to live in poverty, and will see that getting an education is important to having a good life. I believe that if more people could get an education, the quality of life here in Minnesota would be raised. Educated people get better jobs, lead more independent lives, and contribute more to their communities. Our colleges will create the educated workforce that we need to get back, to get out of this recession, and to get our state and our country back on track. Thank you for the invitation to speak today and for listening.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here.
Good afternoon, Chair Fishback and members. I'm Deb Nelson, a non-traditional returning student at Ed Stentry College. I attended college when I was younger, but with continuing promotions at the petroleum equipment company I worked at, the workload and the hours got too long, and I ended up stopping college and never finishing the degree after several years. I took on all the work I could to raise my kids after my divorce, and back then, experience and a good work ethic earned promotions. I found now that that's no longer the case. I've learned through experience that a college degree is not a luxury or an alternate path to success, but a necessity nowadays. Prior to December 2007, I was assistant to the director at a corporation, and he unexpectedly passed away, and his heirs closed the company. Suddenly, I was back in the job market, only to discover that without a degree, I couldn't even get into an interview. I was fortunate enough to be able to return to school through the Dislocated Workers Program so that I could attempt to earn a degree so I could once again hopefully find a fulfilling full-time position. Returning to school reminded me how much I love learning and helping others, so I actually have changed to an education degree. And I also take part-time music classes, as I've got a part-time choir directing position that in order to keep, I need to take some classes and get updated and have some education there. And also, my counselor has since advised me to also complete my AA so that I have a few more options open. One problem that a lot of non-traditional students like me face when you come back is that when you test in, it's been a lot of years since you've been in school. Math especially seems to cause a lot of difficulty. It's been a while since algebra. So it ends up costing you more money taking those non-credit classes and wasting money on that. I've actually bought the textbook, and I'm going to try to teach myself. Wish me luck. I was on track to finish my degree this spring. However, this fall I was diagnosed with cancer, so now I had to cut back on my credit load, and I'll have to return in the fall to finish, which means I've spent more than four semesters at the two-year college, which means that I won't finish the four-year college in my 4 years. So if tuition continues to rise too much, I worry that I'll be able to finish my degree. I've already taken out a loan, and taking the debt makes me a little bit nervous. I work multiple part-time jobs. I direct a choir. I lead children programs at other churches. I do some on-call office work, whatever I can. But I need to earn my degree, and I'm hoping that by earning a two-year degree, I can get one well-paid part-time job while I'm trying to finish, or two maybe, while I try to finish my four-year degree. Otherwise, I'll be in the same situation I am now, overqualified and underdegreed. Being able to attend the community college has helped me attain an education at a more affordable cost than I could have at a four-year institution. And a lot of traditional, non-traditional students like me are back there because we were laid off. And Century College offers us an opportunity to dream of when we will once again have a fulfilling full-time position and have the credentials we need to rejoin the workforce. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being here. And we also wish you the best in your fight with cancer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we'll stand for any questions the committee may have.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I just want to thank these students because they were all very inspiring and really made me understand what it's like to be a student right now, and that's really, thank you for being here, and good luck to all of you.
Senator Sharon.
Two of you are students that, one coming through high school, but two returning after having other careers or having started your education, if I understood you correctly. Can you tell me a little bit about, did the initiative to go back emerge from yourself? Did someone invite you, suggest it? How did that happen? And then what was the process that you had to go through to reenter into the higher ed system?
Well, when I was first out of high school, I just decided that I had enough of school and I was just going to take a break and work and decide what I wanted to do. And then about a year or a little over a year, I found out I was pregnant with my daughter and moved to California and so forth. And in 2005, I divorced and I moved back to Minnesota because that's where my hometown is Owatonna. And I needed my mom and dad's help and support through that since I had a three-year-old child that I would need help with. And I worked in the at Lowe's down in Owatonna, and then I got a job at the Pizza Ranch and ended up working there for about a year. And I just decided I can't, for myself and for my daughter, I couldn't just live that paycheck-to-paycheck mentality and not have, you know, benefits and, you know, make a better quality of life for my daughter and I. You know, I wanted to show her that being a single mom won't stop you from achieving your dreams and your goals and so forth. And I wanted to instill that in her. And the process to get back into school was pretty, you know, seamless. I, you know, looked around. I had talked to my aunt, who was also in, she's a medical laboratory technician down in St. Mary's in Rochester, Minnesota. And she had been talking, and I've been was trying to figure out what would be a good profession for me to go in and so forth. And she had, you know, pushed me to maybe do that because there's a vast shortage of MLTs in the hospitals and clinics in Minnesota. And so she said that there that would be a good job market for me once I graduated, that I could, you know, for sure get a job, you know, in today's economy that was promising for me. And so I ended up, you know, looking at several colleges, and South Central College in Faribault had the program, and it was only half an hour drive from where I was living. So I chose that and, you know, just went through their application process, the AccuPlacer testing, and, you know, getting transcripts from Owatonna and so forth from my high school, and it was pretty seamless. So it was, you know, and then, you know, I've been there since, and I'll graduate in May, so.
Ms. Nelson.
Madam Chair and members, I actually, while I had the assistant to the director position, I also had a position in a church, and I knew that position was ending, but I had my business position, so I felt pretty secure because I knew that while I was looking for additional work, I would have that job, and then, of course, he passed away. And then I found out that churches don't pay unemployment, so you don't get any money from them when you're out of work. Luckily, because of the business job, I qualified for unemployment, which is how I got into the dislocated worker program. But unfortunately, I didn't. I'm a bright person who learns really well and has always had a job. And I didn't do things well. I found out about the Workforce Center, and I attended workshops and learned how to do my resume and how to do this, and I did all these things and took a month or two off because I had never taken a vacation. So I'm taking all these classes and learning everything. And then 3 or 4 months later, I applied for unemployment and found out about the dislocated worker program. So that's something people need to do right away when they get laid off. Tell people you know. So it was a little more difficult for me. And then the dislocated workers program was pretty backed up. They didn't take a waiting list at the time, and it was full. So things have changed, I think, since then, and maybe there was more funding, but there wasn't enough funding to get in right away. But I did get in. I couldn't have made it back in without the dislocated workers program, quite frankly.
Further questions from the committee? thank you all for being Senator Tomasoni, just put one in the end.
It's pretty interesting that that we talk about all, well, I mean, some of these statistics we're seeing here about cutting funding and raising tuition, but in order to get people back to work or lose their jobs, they still need state help, and they still need to get some money from programs that we've set up to help people get back into the workforce, people who want to work, people who are very concerned about being productive citizens. And oftentimes when we're cutting government and claiming that we're doing the right thing, we're taking away opportunities from people. And our college tuition going up as it is going to be a problem in the very near future. And I think Senator Saxog using the sucking sound analogy is might be one of the things that ends up happening here in Minnesota, or maybe it's happening already. And to see Minnesota on the list of at 28th of our funding for our students in school, and seeing North Dakota at number 2, makes you wonder what's going on here. And that maybe we've got to try to start to turn this thing around. And I know my son, I think, owes $80,000. And you wonder how do you pay the mortgage when you get out of college and you don't have a house and you don't have a job. And so then you buy a house, and so then you got two mortgages, and then you buy a car, and then you do all the things that you do as you get into life. But college education should be a means to getting into the workforce and becoming a productive citizen, not something that is a roadblock to getting there. And and so I think we got to figure out a way to mitigate this problem of the price of college going up. And the, you know, the PSEO program is a pretty interesting one. Are you still in it, or are you out of high school now?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I apologize. And members, yes, I'm still in the PSEO program. I will be graduating from high school, so then I will no longer be able to be a part of the PSEO program.
Well, correct, but... See, I told my son to do that, and he was worried. He was worried about what sort of happened to you, that he wouldn't have any social life in the high school. And I told him, don't worry about that. You'll figure that out. You're a smart kid. But so instead of having 2 years of college paid for, he's paying for 2 years of college now. But so at any rate, that's
Senator Tomasoni. The moral of that story is your kids don't listen to you either.
They don't. A lot of people don't. What did you listen to?
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't know. I had a friend who was thinking about doing it, and then my mom attended Inverhills Community College, and she said it was fantastic, so I decided to try it out. Still nervous, of course, but it is absolutely fantastic, and I'm so thankful for the PSEO program.
And let me add my compliments to the other ones also for going back to school and doing what you need to do to put your life back into the shape that you want it to be in. It's very difficult once you get older. And, you know, I'm wondering about, you know, what happens when you get to be my age. Now, who was here before? Say, 18 months. You know, 18 months ago. When you get to be my age, you say 40 years ago.
Scary.
Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The next group we have is the Minnesota State University Student Association, and I believe Mr. Spaeth and Ms. Steen are here. Thank you very much for being here.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the invitation to join you today. My name is Caitlin Steen, and I'm currently a student at Winona State University. I serve as the vice chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. I am before you today to provide you some background about our organization. I represent MSUSA and the importance of our state role in public higher education. MSUSA represents over 75,000 students attending the 7 state universities in the MSU system. These include Bemidji State, Mankato, Winona State, Southwest State and Marshall, St. Cloud State, Moorhead, and Metropolitan State University right here in St. Paul. MSUSA was established 44 years ago in 1967 as an independent nonprofit organization funded and operated by students. Today, the MSU Board of Trustees recognizes us as a leader in the system and as a sole representative of the state university students. At the system level, our organization represents students' issues, interests on a wide range of issues, including financial aid, academic policies, and project management. State university students in the MinSCU system are in a unique position to help the state weather these tough economic times and continue to educate the 21st century workforce. Together, with the two-year institutions in MinSCU, we produce over 60% of the graduates in Minnesota. 80% of those graduates stay and work here in Minnesota, becoming the future business leaders, entrepreneurs, engineers, nursing, and technicians we desperately need. Our state university system students are not asking themselves what we need to do to become competitive. Instead, we are asking how we can continue to work towards excellence and push our system to become the most innovative, creative, and highest quality in the nation. In 1980, the state funded 80% of higher education costs. It's no coincidence that 31 years later, in 2011, Minnesota has more Fortune 500 companies per capita than any other state. The Best Buys, Targets, 3Ms, and small business communities that is prevalent in our state are here due to part to our highly skilled workforce and the unique life quality of life we enjoy. Our students, just as you, are concerned about the economic reality of our state's deficit. However, we cannot afford to sacrifice Minnesota's economic vitality and competitiveness by continuing to restrict access to higher education. Today, students pay 56% of public higher education costs, and we have seen tuition increases over 100% in the last decade. According to the Office of Higher Education, the average student in Minnesota is graduating with $26,000 in debt. It is hard for our graduates to contribute to the economy when they are shouldered with this kind of debt. In closing, the students attending our state colleges and universities today are the leaders of tomorrow. If Minnesota wants to compete in a global market, we need to give our students and our future leaders the opportunity to become entrepreneurs, innovators, teachers, and healthcare and care providers the 21st century requires. Minnesota enjoys the quality of life that we have today, in part because of the investment in education our state has made in the past. For every dollar the state spends in Minnesota colleges and universities, the return on investment is $10.87. Reductions in the state appropriation will continue to burden Minnesota's future and our state's economic vitality. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Spaeth.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Andrew Spaeth. I'm a student at Bemidji State University, and I serve as the chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association that Caitlin provided you a little overview of. I want to take this opportunity to provide with you kind of my personal story and tell you a little bit about how higher education has had really a dramatic impact on not only my life, but my family's life as well, and how funding cuts have impacted our students and more specifically the institution that I attend, Bemidji State University. I grew up in Montevideo, Minnesota. It's a small agricultural community in the southwest part of the state. My grandparents have an eighth grade education, and they knew in order for my father to be successful and my parents to be successful, they needed to have a higher education. That was mandatory. My grandparents saved money and paid for my father to attend and graduate from Southwest State University in Marshall. My mother received an associate's degree from Riverland Community College and actually met my father at Southwest State while pursuing her bachelor's degree. It was instilled into me, like all of you have instilled into your children, that after you graduate from high school, you pursue a higher education in Minnesota. I come from a uniquely large family. I have 9 younger siblings, many of which are in the Minnesota State Colleges and University system. I have 2 brothers attending Minnesota State University in Mankato. I have a sister attending Minnesota State Community and Technical College in Fergus Falls, and another brother attending Southwest State University in Marshall. My family is dependent on public higher education, and our future is really reliant on it. As Caitlin mentioned, MSUSA serves over 75,000 students in Minnesota. Around the table and in the room today, there are a number of leaders that come from St. Cloud State, Bemidji State, Southeast Technical College, a number of the institutions that really make our state great and have provided us with some of the great leaders here in this room, but also great leaders amongst Minnesota. Our students are dedicated to that level of success and want to succeed, but our path is not going to be easy. As Caitlin mentioned, our students are graduating with nearly $26,000 in debt. It provides a massive challenge once we enter the job market and try to start our families and our lives. Bemidji State University is currently in the process of cutting roughly $5 million from their budget, which is nearly 10% of their biannual operating budget. I want to outline what they're calling or what the university has kind of coined the recalibration process, which is defined as no across-the-board cuts, really looking at resculpting, reshaping the university to provide and continue to provide high quality graduates. But this is having a dramatic impact on students. The cuts that will take place are going to impact the visual arts, English and speech, history, philosophy, modern languages, music, physics, environmental studies, sociology, economics, mathematics, computer science, accounting, technology studies, professional education, psychology, physical education, health, and sports management areas of colleges at the university. Elimination also of the theater program, our history program, half of the graduate assistant positions at the university, the elimination of the men's track and field program, and the elimination of the Paul Bunyan transportation program that many of our students use are also no longer going to be available fiscal year 2012. Our students play a crucial role in our state's economic future and in the long-term financial success of Minnesota. And our 75,000 students would urge you to really keep that at the forefront of your thoughts and in your consideration as you move forward through the legislative session. So thank you, and we'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
And can I say go Huskies? When you said the St. Cloud State, I had to put in a little plug.
Go there?
Yeah. Graduated from there. And next we have the sorry, Senator Roblin.
I'm just a little bit scratching my head here as I hear about the average state debt for the Minsky, I think it was 4-year college students being $26,000. And maybe that was a statewide average and not just Minscule. But I'm also looking at the annual tuition of $6,500, almost $6,600. And pretty much if you had a $26,000 debt, that meant that you completely financed your tuition payments with loans. And that just seems unusual to me. That, I mean, yes, you have living expenses, but a lot of students get family assistance and they get financial aid, and there's a $2,500 federal tax deduction that they can get. And so I really would like somebody to explain to me why loan levels are getting so high. I'm just struggling with that idea. What are they borrowing all the money for? Because for many students, there is assistance. And so to think that the average loan debt is $26,000 just doesn't make fiscal sense to me. Unless they're fully financing their education with student loans and then using other revenues for other purposes. And maybe that's what's happening. And I know the students who have families certainly have some pretty significant financial obligations. and I can understand that. They would have those obligations whether or not they were in school or not, but they definitely have obligations. So, but and I don't know who at some point can ever explain the student loan debt.
Well, and we can, if there, if any of the folks who testified want to come to the table and try to, Mr. Spaeth, do I see that? Maybe you want to give us a few minutes. We are, I will just warn everybody, I've got a few more people, and we've got about 25 minutes, so, but we can also do a little more investigation on, maybe talk to Office of Higher Ed and see if they've got some statistics and information on that, too. So, but Mr. Spaeth?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. I just want to clarify that the $26,000 number is statewide, all the students graduating from a Minnesota higher education institution. So that includes the private institutions, that includes the two-year institutions, the public state universities. So that's a kind of a general figure, just for clarification's sake.
Okay, thank you.
And Senator Roebling will try to find some more information out about where, you know, what's going on with those loans, too. Thank you very much, Mr. Spaeth.
Yeah, thank
you. The next group that we have is Minnesota State College faculty. I have Mr. Kapke, Ms. Satti, and Mr. Ryan. Thank you for being here. And I don't know who would like to begin, if you just identify yourself for
sure.
The record and go ahead.
For the record, my name is Damon Kapke. I am Minnesota State College faculty vice president for liberal arts, and I'm an English faculty member from Lake Superior College. With me today are Jennifer Satti from Anoka Technical College and Ken Ryan from Alexandria Technical and Community College. MSCF represents 5,000 faculty members, or nearly 5,000 faculty members, approximately half of whom are liberal arts transfer educators like myself, and about half are career technical and occupational educators. I want to thank you for this opportunity to share with you some of the great things that are happening in our classrooms, places where teaching and learning take place. In our visits with members of this committee and your colleagues, it has come to our attention that many of you would benefit from a snapshot of what we do at some of our colleges. So today we have asked a couple of our fellow faculty members to talk to you about some unique programs that they have developed in conjunction with business and industry. We ask that you listen to these presentations as if you were prospective students or parents who want to learn more about what the faculty do at our two-year colleges. So I would like to begin with Jennifer Satti from Anoka Technical College. She's here to talk about judicial reporting and captioning. And by the way, we have two handouts. One of them is about judicial reporting, and the other one is going to be about Alexandria Technical College and the mechatronics program.
Ms. Satti.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to let me speak. I have the great privilege of teaching students, individuals to train for a fascinating career in court reporting. Court reporting now is real time, and what we do is we train for four different careers. Real time, just so you can get a picture of this, is actually writing on a steno machine, like you've seen in courtrooms. You write on a steno machine, you have customized software. And what we can do now with the technology that has advanced so far is we write on our steno machine and picture this. Instantaneously, the words appear on the computer screen. So that's an amazing thing that we can do, and we have a high interest in the program. We have a full program, and our graduates are getting jobs right off the bat. The four careers that we're training for are, first, freelance court reporter, and that is someone who goes into the deposition field. They work with law firms, and they write down depositions and prepare transcripts. The second career is the official reporter, the judicial reporter, where they work in the courtroom with the judicial team, with the judge, et cetera. The third career is the captioner. And the legislature, whatever is on TV, is actually captioned. So if you were to watch part of the sessions here, you could turn the TV on and see a very qualified captioner write the proceedings. And we actually have an intern student right now with the captioner who's captioning So well, today, so
maybe captioning right now because we are on TV. So.
Exactly. So hi, Christy.
let's give a shout out. All right.
Have fun. We all want you to do well. but it's a fascinating career. I mean, we now have these opportunities where they can, and captioners caption from home. So this is a career you stay home. And you're sending the feed, real-time feed, to the TV stations. And you can just be relaxed and comfortable. You don't have the transportation fees. What this also does is opens up the career for people who live in the rural communities.
Excuse me just a minute.
Chair,
Senator Tomasoni has a question.
I have to tell Christy that taconite is one word. Because
Oh, no. Honor to continue.
The last time I saw it, it came out Taco Night, okay? So
okay, was this on TV?
It was on TV.
Okay. and Senator Tomasoni.
okay.
Senator Tomasoni, were you speaking?
Then I have to say.
Because you need to speak clearly for those folks.
Wasn't me. I was watching.
Yeah. Was the speaker speaking clearly?
That is why I was calling Senator Tomasoni on that.
I want Christy to know taconite's one word.
Okay. And just so everybody knows, Senator Tomasoni's here all week. Tip your waitresses. Miss Sadi.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. This is a unique on-the-spot, like you experienced watching last night, you know, we have very high accuracy, but we really are on-the-spot writing. So if you picture yourself trying to type and not make a typo at all when you're going. But you will see generally very good good captioning out there. And we have a strong national association that works on quality control. Very involved with our program. They really love our program. We have state association involvement. The fourth career that people can train for is being a CART provider. CART is providing reasonable accommodation for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. So what we typically use that for is, like in a classroom, if you have someone who's deaf or hard of hearing, a real-time reporter will come and set up next to that student, and then they follow along and they read what the instructor is saying and participating fully in the class. Now, we can also do this wirelessly. So now we're able to provide CART, you know, and the student doesn't have to feel like they're everyone's watching them. So they really fit in the class really well. Let's see, what else? Students are being trained to go into a professional career. So even though we're at a two-year college, you know, they are entering a profession that they are regarded as highly technical professionals. And we are the only program in the state. We are called on as experts quite often. All the instructors at our program, they have the highest certifications, and we just have amazing results and amazing interest in our program. We also train working reporters so that they can become real-time. Years ago, they weren't real-time, and so we do a lot of retraining of workers. There's also last year, President Obama signed a new act, the 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act of 2010, and that has opened up a lot of new careers because now any video placed online must be captioned as well. So that's we're continually creating new career options for court reporters, real-time reporters. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ryan?
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you. For the record, my name is Ken Ryan. I'm the director of the Center for Applied Mechatronics at Alexandria Technical and Community College. I'm proud to be a career and technical educator for the state of Minnesota, and I also have to be a bit of an evangelist because not many people know what mechatronics is. So I'm from the government. I'm here to help. Mechatronics is a combination of mechanical, electrical, and electronic engineering with what we call informatics, which is networking and computer technology. We train at what we call the technologist level, and we are essentially the clutch that engages the engineering engine of our state. If you think about our engineering programs at four-year schools here in the state of Minnesota, those are very theoretical, design-based programs. They come up with the ideas. We're the ones that make them work. So the technologist essentially will take the engineering design process and take it down to the level of implementation, maintenance, and operation. I talk about there being three different levels because we, of course, have the engineering level. We do not teach engineers. We have the technologist level, which is essentially that individual that will work directly with engineers. They have a very broad-based, over-the-horizon view, I might say, of what the coming technologies are and how they get applied to engineering solutions. So they really are that implementation phase. And then finally, we have the technician level. These may be operators, they may be maintenance technicians. They are responsible for the life cycle management of that engineering technology. Ours is a rather difficult career because the technology that we're involved with is moving very rapidly. We have to be able to create very nimble technicians and technologists. We have to have a very acute sense of what it is that industry needs from these technicians, not yesterday, not today, but in the next 5 years and next 10 years, as their economic competitiveness depends greatly on those technologists and technicians being aware. I have given you some information. I both emailed this and also it was sent out to you as individual packets. There is some information here about what mechatronics is and what its history is and how we apply it. There's some additional information about the Center for Applied Mechatronics at Alexandria Technical Community College, where our two-year students earn a bachelor's in applied science. Now, you hear me using that term over and over again, applied. It's applied mechatronics. It's an applied technology degree. This is really an application specialty. So you can read that at your leisure. But one of the things that I would like to point out is this last document that was in that packet. There's some highlighting on that. I'd like to read just that first paragraph for you if I could. This is about a company in Alexandria who makes this company makes a very specialized genetic technology equipment that they put out in the market worldwide. 2 years ago, when Brent Erke and his coworkers at Douglas Machine Incorporated in Alexandria started a spin-off company, he knew he would need skilled workers, but he wanted more than traditionally trained electricians, mechanics, and programmers. To quote him, "You can't be one-dimensional when you're a startup company," Erke said. "We were looking for people who wear multiple hats, and that's exactly what we found with graduates from the mechatronics program at Alexandria Technical and Community College." This is just a snapshot of the type of graduate that we produce. These are, as I said, individuals that cross a multitude of disciplines, mechanical, electrical, electronic, and informatics. And I tell you what, I'm immensely proud, number one, to be a career and technical educator in our state. Number two, I'm immensely proud of our students. This morning we had the privilege of hosting our Chancellor-elect, Dr. Stephen Rosenstone, who was at Alec Tech this morning. Our students were there in the lab answering questions for him, introducing him to the technology they were working on, and I was very proud. Now, it's our little secret that I think Dr. Rosenstone thought I woke up and put a suit on this morning for his honor. But in fact, we know the truth, don't we, now?
Except remember, we're televised, Mr. Ryan.
Now he knows.
As I said, I'm grateful for the opportunity to share what we do. And I want to also point out, mine is but one story in a number of stories. I'm very proud, as I said, to be a career and technical educator in our state. And also very proud to work at the two-year education level. I really think that what we do is critical for this state. It's critical, as Senator Saxhouse mentioned earlier, or Saxhaug, I'm sorry, mentioned earlier in terms of the viability, economic viability of the state. But just on a personal note, I also am a product of a public education. After receiving my doctorate in medicine from the state of Iowa at the University of Iowa and completing my surgical residency there, I emigrated to the state of Minnesota 25 years ago and have been paying taxes in the state ever since and am proud to do so. I look at the burden that we are placing on students in answer to Senator Roebling's question, too, about what it costs to get educated, not just in this state but in any state. And what it costs and the burden that we're asking these students to carry out after that time. I have the good fortune of having been able to change careers, and because of the strong history of collective bargaining that exists throughout our unions, I was able to step into an education role and still make a living that allowed me to support my two children, one now in a public institution and one at St. John's. I can pay for that education because I've been given the opportunity to be an economic participant in this state. I ask you only that our students in the future have that same opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I would stand for any questions with my colleagues.
Any comments or questions? We are tight on time, but we have one more group, the University. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Madam.
We appreciate it. We have the University of Minnesota faculty. We have Russ Lupke, Phyllis Moen, and Tom Molitor. And thank you all for being here. So, would ever like to go first? Just identify yourself for the record. And
yes, I'm Russell Lupke, Madam Chair and members. It's a hard act to follow after hearing these inspiring student stories, but I'll try. I'm Russell Lupke. I'm a cardiologist and epidemiologist in the School of Public Health at University of Minnesota. I am also Mayo Professor of Public Health and Professor of Medicine. I'm going to briefly discuss the teaching and research that I do, emphasizing that these activities are intertwined and interdependent, and that they are unique to institutions like the University of Minnesota. In my teaching, I mainly am going to describe my graduate teaching, but I also teach two undergraduate courses. I'm the director of the graduate program in clinical research. 51 students are enrolled in an MS program. They are all clinicians. You have to be a physician or dentist or pharmacist with a doctoral degree to enter the program. Most have finished their specialty training. We train people to do research on disease diagnosis and treatment in people. The methods are sophisticated, and the burden on people to do it right is enormous. And we train those folks to the highest standard. Our competition are places like Wisconsin, Iowa, Harvard, Stanford, Duke, and we feel our program, because it draws nationally, is equal to those, and some of us think it may be a bit better. I'm going to give you two brief examples of the intertwining of teaching and research in what I do. The first is an example from Parkinson's disease. And some of you may know people with Parkinson's disease. It's a debilitating and deadly disease. I have a student who's a neurosurgeon. Takes 8 years of training after medical school to become a neurosurgeon. But she's taking courses in our program and does research in neurostimulation, implanting electrodes in patients' brains. And it is extraordinary to watch patients who have severe tremors have these electrodes activated and stop having that. Her research is supported by the federal government and Medtronic, who are very interested in this technology. The second, and may involve actually some of the constituencies you represent, is stroke. Likewise, a debilitating disease. And in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Health, we and our students are involved, our master's students in public health, in a study of hospitals, both small and large in this state, and how they treat stroke. Are they treating stroke with the best technology in acute treatment and rehabilitation that we know? And many are not. And part of this program, which is supported by the Centers for Disease Control, is to train physicians and staff in hospitals so they are treating stroke so people have the best outcomes from this disease. It is also research. So, you know, the University of Minnesota, this is a unique program in our state. It attracts the brightest clinicians, I have to say. I'm fortunate for the students I teach. It provides highly, highly skilled people working at Medtronic, St. Jude's, the rest of the high-tech industry that supports much of this state. It attracts external funding to the university and the state. Last year, fiscal 10, I brought in $4.6 million in external funds, which creates jobs and opportunities for people. But most importantly, the people we train and the things we do improve the health of our citizens, both in Minnesota and throughout the country. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Ms. Mullen?
Madam Chair and committee members, I wish to take some time away from my own prepared remarks to just give you a little bit of background about how I arrived here. I was so inspired by what the students said earlier. So the fact is that I was in the late 70s, I was a recent widow, age 32, in Crookston, and applied to graduate school to the University of Minnesota because I realized I couldn't support my two young daughters. My husband died very suddenly. We had no life insurance because he was 34. We didn't think we needed it. I came here and was well supported by this university, working as a graduate student, but also able to live in Commonwealth Terrace near the St. Paul campus, and able to meet the loans and make do with the monies that I got as a graduate student, which I don't think is true anymore. I think the costs have gone up and the money is not there. In response to what Senator Saxhog said, those educated in Minnesota don't necessarily stay in Minnesota, but they often come back if they don't. I got a job at Cornell University and was there for 25 years. That was my only job, and was recruited back here to the university in 2003. And I'm very proud to be here and very proud of my Minnesota education. I gave a handout of our center and what we're doing. I just want to tell you briefly about this project, and it's about stressed workers and overworked workers. The workforce has changed. Most members of the workforce, male or female, don't have the luxury of a full-time homemaker. Most people feel pressed for time, that often due to a competitive global labor market, but also to the fact that downsizing means that many people, those who don't lose their jobs, have to do the work of two or three people. So what we were interested in, my colleague Aaron Kelly and myself, is how do we promote flexibility, and not just flexibility on the books, what often people have, but nobody uses, or else you have to get special permission to do so, but real flexibility to enable you to manage all the multiple balls of strands of your lives. We found out that Best Buy, one of our premier homegrown corporations in Minnesota, was launching an innovation that gave people real flexibility. So we went there very quickly and surveyed people before and after this new innovation occurred. It's called ROW, Results Only Work Environment. And the goal of ROW is to stop focusing on time at your desk or in meetings and rather on the results that you're supposed to get done. So it's very different than usual flexibility programs. It's sort of extreme flexibility. We studied both the members of the corporation who went through ROW and a comparison group of those who were going through it later on. And looking at them over time, we did more than 100 interviews. We did two surveys. We had our students follow and shadow and sit in six different work teams to figure out what is going on with ROW. Just briefly, what we found is that those under experiencing ROW felt more control, more schedule control over their time, and that reduced their work-family conflict. I didn't say it, but 70% of Americans say they experience work-family conflict. So this is a common phenomenon, and it was reduced for those under ROW. They felt greater time availability to do things, non-work things, like be with their families, as well as be engaged in community activities and other activities. In terms of health-related behavior, we found that people were more likely to go to the doctor when sick, if necessary, and to stay at home when they were sick. They also did more exercise and reported an extra hour's sleep at night because they could modify their time. Looking at turnover, we found that the people who participate in row, there was a 45% decrease in turnover rate among them compared to the comparison group over the 8 months of the study. So this has a lot of implications, we believe, for the people of the state of Minnesota. First, this is an innovation that is taking off both in other agencies and companies within the state, but also nationwide and also internationally. So it's giving high prominence to what we all know about Minnesota, that it's a very innovative state. It also is promoting quality of work and quality of life for growing numbers of workers who are experiencing this kind of change. It is reducing the costs of turnover and as well as enabling companies to retain their talented workforce. It's also being used as a recruitment tool. People are interested in working at a place that treats them like adults. And finally, one of the things that we didn't recognize but has happened is it's really changed the way people in these kinds of row environments commute to work. They don't go when it's rush hour. They don't take the 45 minutes to an hour to get to work. They take 10 or 15 minutes by changing when they go by an hour or so. And I'll just conclude with what one of our respondents said. Row is going to be the way all corporations work in the future. Once people start to understand that it's all about results and not about time, employees will be much happier and companies will be more efficient. My team really needs to convert to row as soon as possible. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we have bought ourselves a few minutes of time to keep the room, so Dr. Molitor?
Yes. Madam Chair, members, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you. Like others have said, it's very difficult to follow students with their wonderful stories. And my task is to try to address, like we all, what does a university do for the state of Minnesota, and what are some examples of that? To introduce myself, I'm a professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine on St. Paul as part of the University of Minnesota, and I'm in the Population Medicine Department, which is the large animal and public health aspects of veterinary medicine. And our university and college plays a critical role in the health of Minnesotans through assuring food safety, conducting research on biomedical, including using animal models for human disease, prevention of diseases transmitted from animals to humans, zoonotic diseases. We want to enhance our physical and psychological well-being through the care of companion animals. And we also want to protect the state's wildlife natural resources. And these are all critically important facets that professional school of veterinary medicine is necessary in order to address this. And for a few examples in terms of that you may not have thought about in terms of the role we have. First of all, protecting Minnesota waters by surveillance and testing of diseases of fish, and education and training related to serving the expanding aquaculture industry in the state. There's a recent disease that's happened in the Great Lakes called viral hemorrhagic septicemia, kind of Ebola of fish, that has a great impact in terms of affecting the fish industries in the state, among other diseases. And it's an important aspect that our school and our training has expanded in terms of trying to address these areas, both that can affect tourism and certainly the aquaculture industry. Second example, and I'm going to say this carefully, moving the classroom life experience, emphasis on moving. And that is that we have developed a unique model for dairy education by a private-public partnership with down in New Swede, Minnesota, in building a state-of-the-art education facility that is a private enterprise and thus does not cost the state money to for this facility, but provides a unique experience for the veterinarian interested in dairy medicine, certainly an important aspect to the state in terms of dairy production and milk source. And this is a facility that's helped develop, put Minnesota on a map as a center. Evidenced by a recent application for federal funding in order to have this center be a national center of excellence. And again, this is I'll quote one student down there. A lot of people say that if you want to learn a language, you should be immersed in the culture. And this is from a veterinary student. This is an immersion. We live here, we stay here, and it allows us to see all aspects that go on in a dairy facility. And so this is an operation that, an opportunity that allows not only veterinary students, but now other expanded educational experience, as well as research. Most recently, it's been an opportunity to develop one of the only places in the country where you can have animal handling experience, stockmanship, and this is a new venture. You've heard about such things as chronic wasting disease in helping wildlife in opportunities for jumping to potential diseases from animals to humans. Important aspect is, in fact, addressing through research and education, protecting the agricultural animals in the state and humans from disease and the spread of infection of deadly diseases. Investigators at the school in the School of Public Health have spent a decade developing and implementing procedures to prevent introduction and spread of infectious diseases, such as swine influenza, which is not only been an important disease to affect the swine industry, but also an important aspect in Minnesota for humans. This has important implications in terms of our agricultural industries if we cannot protect that and if we cannot train individuals to further that. Another important aspect is the animal human environmental interface and something, a term called ecosystem health, and how the animals have an impact. That's an important area of both research and educational training that is necessary as we go move forward in terms of being both an important agricultural state, but in also to protecting the environment. The last point I want to make, and one that's been made repeatedly, is that as one of the only professional or the only veterinary school in the state, we serve 100% of our graduates serve the state. We have, as stated before, we have people from outside of the state that come in for veterinary training, and many of them stay here. An important role is to develop and train these future leaders. And this veterinary, highly trained workforce that cannot be done at few places. This is important for our food protection and defense as well as is our animal health and animal well-being. It's important to recognize that the interface between public health and these animal industries is critical as protecting that food source and potential emerging diseases. We also, it's important to train future researchers that can develop new technologies and approaches in order to help the state of Minnesota. We also, as mentioned, need to protect the wildlife and, importantly, that potential interface. And so we recognize that these are all important aspects, and we need to continue to develop that. Thank you for
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Well, thank you very much, and I know we went a little over, but I thought we should hear everybody. And so thank you very much for being here, and I appreciate everyone, all the committee members hanging in there, and we are adjourned.